welcome once again to the Nerdstravaganza podcast, where tonight we are still missing 90% of our co-hosts, but we will be joined by local author and gaming aficionado, Christopher Robin Negline. We're going to skip the Weekly Geekly this week because with just one of us, it feels masturbatory, quite honestly. So let's jump straight into our interview with Chris. Thanks for joining us tonight, Chris. How are you?
No, I'm not too bad. How are you?
Doing well. I guess to start, tell us who you are and why you're here. I mean, I know, but not everyone's going to be hanging out with you all the time. So
I guess I'm here for a little bit of two reasons. One is as I'm trying to be starting a career as an ebook writer as well as traditional writer. Professionally, I've been an award-winning copywriter and advertising guy and even did newspaper journalism back in the day. But I've always, you know, had my eye on the prize of doing fiction writing. And, you know, especially for the past few years, I've gone out to different conferences and conventions and to kind of get what I need to know to start my career, especially on the e-publishing side, which has massively changed. And a lot of professional writing organizations have massively changed their opinion about e-publishing in the last 5 years. I mean, to see these bureaucratic organizations literally turn on a dime is like watching an elephant do a pirouette. It's just amazing. And then also, you know, I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. Been running role-playing games and doing board games for, oh, holy, longer than maybe some of your listeners are around.
Yeah, I don't like to admit what year my first game was in or anything anymore.
Nope. Actually, now that I think about it, I think I got into the writing thing only a couple of years before I got into the role-playing thing and the gaming thing. I was on a farm. I was the stereotypical geeky kid who hated being on the farm and wanted to be something more than a farmer. And I had literally devoured everything that my public school had had in the science fiction and fantasy shelf. And then even managed to find one of those really old sleeved sets of Lord of the Rings with the old style drawings on them that have like nothing to do with the actual story inside. And I think Tolkien really didn't like them, but have come kind of synonymous with the old school stuff. What had happened was I ran out. So I figured, what the heck? I'll start writing my own stories, and just kept plugging away at that for forever. Everyone has a flaw for a long time when they're a writer before it finally clicks. And mine was I could never finish anything. I always would start a story or a novel, and then at some point it would get too tough or I'd get stuck, and then some other new shiny bauble idea or thing would come up, and I'd just start off on something else for a long time.
Great at starting stories, huh?
Yes. Great at starting stories and coming up with really crazy ideas that kind of dovetailed into my role-playing because I could come up with scenarios and stuff, but, you know, finishing it was another story for a long time.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who's actually finished a campaign.
Oh, well, that's a whole different story, finishing campaigns as compared to, like, finishing novels. In fact, it got to the point where, you know, I've just totally dropped the whole idea of doing a prophecy. Well, you three, no four, no six, no two, will be the ones that carry the great bauble to the Mount Doom, you know? You know, there has been talk about there's, like, cross-play between the two hobbies, you know, writing and D&D. In fact, the New York Times put out an article by several Pulitzer Prize-winning authors who credit Dungeons & Dragons is that first building block that got them started on the road to writing. Now, most of these guys didn't stay in genre fiction or never even went into genre fiction when they wrote, but it was that initial burst of creativity and freedom that got them going and started their career. Of course, you know, 5-10 years ago, nobody would say that. I mean, you know, one of the bigger fantasy authors we have nowadays, China Mayville, who's like adored by most critics, even if they're literary or genre, he wouldn't even really admit. I mean, he would say that he'd read D&D books for inspiration on world building, but still took him a while before he kind of came out of the closet as a role player and said, yeah, I did that. I rolled the dice. Speaking of China Mayville, one of the big things he's been going into lately is where the intersection of where world building goes when it goes too far and when it's just enough for a story. Part of that comes into like what you do for like doing a role playing game. I believe that's the strengths it gave me, was being able to just create details and make a world kind of feel really realistic on the fly, or just be able to come up with details that I think, yeah, that's believable. I mean, overall, at some point you have to realize that you can't, I just want to dissuade people from thinking that if they become a dungeon master, they're going to get the whole tool set. There's a lot of other things they're going to have to do if they want to switch over from being a dungeon master to a writer. You just can't start writing down all the things your players are doing, and then that's your instant novel. That's been tried before, and it doesn't work.
That's like your internship.
Exactly. You know, that's pretty accurate. It'd be like your internship. Don't get me wrong. There's people that have used it as a building block. Raymond E. Feist, it's very well known that his longest series of several books are all based off of his college D&D game.
Well, I think Tolkien, didn't he and his friends get together in that bar and play D&D?
Are you being facetious or are you being not?
No.
You're making a joke. Okay, yeah, just making sure. Because that was delivered very straight face over the...
I wish I could remember the name of the bar now. Shit.
I'm sure they played games. You know, if you ask our buddy, our mutual buddy, the game store owner, he will tell you that in New York, there was a confluence of people who played war games and board games and were also science fiction writers as well.
I think it's great influence. I think it's great passion building. But yeah, it definitely, you can't. I mean, that's what I thought when I was like 12 and first getting into it. I was like, oh, I'll just do a D&D thing and just take meticulous notes and it'll be a great story. And no, not so much.
No, but you know, like I said, it's good for some building blocks, but you got to take it more from there. I mean, probably the biggest thing to think about for writing is the less you invest in it, the less you're going to get out of it. Unfortunately, the opposite is not going to hold true. There's no guarantees in anything in writing. It's one of the professions where there is some luck of the dice and being able to be in the right spot at the right time sometimes. But if you don't invest anything, you're not going to get anything out of it.
I hate to admit how true that is.
Well, it depends on how you go with that. I mean, for me, if you want to go back into like my blog, The Bright Cave, I get into the difference of what I do versus the difference of what other people do when they give some writing advice. Some people give very generic writing advice. I say, this is what has worked for me. No guarantees, but this was my experience with these things. So it's a little more personal. It's a little more in depth for what happened to me. The big thing that happened to me is I would get these big visual mental set pieces in my head. One I thought of for the longest time was like somebody like a cowboy going down a very rainy street. All the trees and the buildings to the sides are being pushed away as these huge footprints, reptilian footprints, are like preceding him and advancing in front of him, as if the cowboy is just this illusion of this some great creature that's like going in. I was like, that's a great idea. And I would try to write to that big set piece, and then when I got done with that money shot, I didn't know where else to go and what else to do with it. At some point, I just realized that was my flaw, and I was going to stick to one novel, and I was just not going to write anything else, not do anything else, until it finished. And I'd also have to admit that it probably was going to be a big piece of steaming crap when I got it done, but at least it was going to get finished. My small bit of pride is that people have told me it's not a complete big piece of crap. It has some potential, which you'd be surprised how many other writers you know and you adore and you admire, that there is that first novel that there was nothing redeeming in it whatsoever. I might go back to it someday, but I have some other things I really want to work with first and see if we can get them off the ground.
That was one of the harder lessons they taught me in school, and it's been popularized as kill your babies.
Oh, yeah. For me, getting your darlings out on the first draft is what keeps you motivated, because you're like, yeah, that's cool. That sounds great. And then when you get back to the editing process and rewriting, because that's where the real engine of writing happens, is when you go back and you rewrite and you rewrite and you rewrite. That's where you start getting around and assessing whether that really cool scene that kept you going before is really even necessary. I am in a monthly writer's workshop, and we had one guy, he came in, big space opera sort of guy, but every time he did everything, he had to mention every loving detail. He wanted you to know that he knew his world was real by just every time he went down the middle of the ship, there was like some sort of transom walkway, and he had to mention that they took that moving walkway every time they went down the middle of the ship.
I actually really don't like repetition like that.
Yeah, and when that was what was killing him, is like, it killed me that he could write this fast and write this much volume of work, but on the flip side, 3/4 of what he wrote, he didn't need to write. And it took us several years of working with him to get him to see where that detail's great, especially in the back of your head, but you don't need to put it all on the page all of the time. So he learned after a while, you know, that maybe one time you go through the hallway and it's the moving walkway. The next time, as they're talking, they may see like a robot that has some sort of organic way of fixing the ship. So then he gives these little details that let you know of the different parts of the universe and how things work. But it's not like every loving bolt is described in like passed by every time they go somewhere. And that goes back to the China Melville bit where, like, you know, how much world building is too much and how much is just enough to get the story going.
And I don't think you're exaggerating at all when you say you worked with him for years.
No. In fact, he just finished up a short story he's going to start submitting. And we realized that he had joined our workshop about 4 years ago. When we first read his stuff, he had the same word count the rest of us did, but it felt like we were reading three times as much with him because it was just repetitive, syrupy, long, thick stuff. It just was like, going on and on and on. And now it's much more. In fact, he says he used to read his favorite authors back in the day, and now he sees it himself about how they're just spinning their wheels, and he's like, come on, get to the story.
Your favorite authors aren't always the best inspiration for today's market.
No, especially not Shakespeare. Well, you know, that's one of the things I read here recently was what makes an author an enduring author. And, you know, a perfect example is H.P. Lovecraft seems to be more enduring than Robert Heinlein. And, I mean, Lovecraft, he's also got a controversy around him because he was rather racist. They say he recanted, but too little too late sort of thing. It's kind of embarrassing because one of the World Fantasy Awards is a bust of H.P. Lovecraft. So giving it to a writer who's African-American or any other sort of ethnicity, it's kind of like, In fact, there was the part of the controversy went on where somebody was trying to suggest another author to substitute the bust for. My suggestion would be pick something that isn't a person, and then you don't have to find accidental flaws with the people. That way we can just remove that out of the equation.
Yeah, maybe you can use an icon instead of someone exactly. Who's going to wind up being a Roman Polanski or something.
Exactly. My personal vote was for Ursula Le Guin, but she's still alive, and I guess there's some sort of unwritten rule. You can't make bust awards out of people still living. So who knows?
In a few years.
If you want to start reading people to know how to write, especially for a more modern audience, Ursula Le Guin is good. Octavia Butler is a goddess. She was the only science fiction writer to ever earn the Arthur McGrath Award, which is known as the Genius Award. Parable of the Sower is a novel I always suggest reading. Hugh Howey, who is almost the literal poster child for being an e-author at Amazon, he started e-publishing more and more, and he got lucky with a really great little story called Wool. And now he's a full-blown author, and he's the champion for, you know, getting your stuff online and out there. Chuck Wendig, who has an awesome blog about writing, Terrible Minds. I think he's a previous guest of yours, right?
Yes, he is.
Awesome guy. I've had the privilege of meeting him once or twice. He's not as profane in person as he is on his blog.
It would be hard to be that profane in person.
But it is highly entertaining, and it does keep you glued. I also heard that recently his new novel set, The Blackbirds, just became a TV series. So kudos to him. He actually was a role-playing writer for White Wolf and some other companies for like literally 20 years.
Yeah, he was saying his word count, I think he said 3 million words
for them. If you included his role-playing stuff, there's no way it couldn't be. Mm. See, in that time period, I was tempted to do that, but then I was still getting gigs doing marketing and advertising, and it would be like, you know, I could do 1,000-2,000 words in that field, and I would almost get paid $1 a word at times. Role playing, no, you don't get that kind of cash. And on top of that, I'd get paid by the end of the month, not 6 or 7 months from now. It probably wouldn't have hurt to have done role playing stuff, but it was just, you know, the financial decision at the time. It was kind of like, I want to, but got responsibilities and people to feed, so I kind of bowed out.
That's one of the things I've always liked about a lot of role-playing stuff, too. It was kind of who you knew because the companies were so small, they couldn't afford to actually shop it out.
Exactly, and you get the same people doing the same things. And some of those things were actually like literal writing exercises. There was an old D6 Star Wars book about aliens, and I found out after the fact ages ago the writer's assignment was, we're going to mail you, because this was before the internet, a whole set of picture of aliens, and on the back of them there's going to be a code. So you can tell us which alien you're talking about. Look at the alien, make it up. It was like a writing exercise for this guy. Something I would have loved to have done. I'm getting to pretend to make up aliens and get paid for it. But, you know, all these cases are 20, 10 years.
Martin, whose big success was like book four, wasn't it?
George R.R. Martin?
Yeah.
He has been a big success repeatedly. He was an award-winning author. Sand Kings was a story that got him an award in Omni magazine, if you want to go that far back. Then he decided he'd try his luck in Hollywood. He did a critically acclaimed and cult TV series, Beauty and the Beast, where Ron Perlman was the Beast. And then in the 90s, he kind of gave up on TV because he kept wanting to do bigger and bigger stories, and there weren't the budgets and the special effects weren't there for him yet. And then he went to his agent, and he asked his agent, should I do fantasy or should I do science fiction? And his agent, I hear, like literally rolled his eyes and said, fantasy, don't even do science fiction. Fantasy's where it's at. And then he wrote about this whole kind of spin he had on, I think, the War of the Roses for England, and that was Game of Thrones. So the guy has been repeatedly in and out of different levels of celebrity, stardom, recognition within the genre field, and at different industries of the genre field. And I've had the privilege of bumping into him a couple of times at a convention called Worldcon, which is a unique convention. One reason why it's unique is you can literally bump into people like George R. R. Martin and say hello and have a chat versus having to pay $5 for his autograph and then, you know, you're
five.
Escorted out. Oh, I'm sorry, five, 20. I don't know. I go to Worldcon. I don't go to the other conventions where, you know, I have to pay for people's autographs. When you go to Worldcon, it's like Disneyland. You pay one price and everything's free. I could tell from talking to him that, you know, he's at this point in his stage where he knows it's all transient and he just needs to enjoy it as it is, because sooner or later it's all going
to
fade.
It might take his stuff a little while to fade now.
Well, you know, the time I'm actually thinking about that attitude of his was way back when it was just a novel. It wasn't even a TV series yet.
Right.
Yes, I'm one of those guys that 13 years ago was very upset and nobody knew why, and all they heard me mutter was, stupid Red Wedding.
Yeah.
And if I have to spoiler that now, 2 years later, you're on your own.
I finally got through all of my friends that came to me and like, dude, you should really read this stuff. It's really good. I read it years ago and I told you about it. You just saw it on HBO. That doesn't make it new.
I knew that Game of Thrones had reached some sort of new level, especially with the TV show, when I saw a sharply dressed grandma and grandpa reading it at the airport. And I mean, they were sharply dressed. They were reading it because they're like, we have to be the hip grandparents, so we can't not know what our grandbabies are talking about.
Wow.
I mean, I could have sworn I saw the guy with an ascot, but I could be wrong. But when it comes to the dedication, besides just the writing, there's going to be more to it than that, because there's also the business side and the networking side. And especially as a farm boy all the way from Oklahoma, you've got to put some cash aside because something's going to cost you something somewhere. A perfect example is the Worldcon I mentioned. Its main focus is the Hugo Awards, which are basically the People's Choice Awards of science fiction. It's not like Dragon Con. It's not like San Diego Comic Con. It is what happens is they even have a thing called a coffee clutch where you get up early in the morning because they go fast and you sign up and you literally get to sit down at the table with about five or six other fans with the person that you want to talk to. And you get like half an hour, and you get to ask questions and talk to this great author that you like. Now, is George R. R. Martin doing a coffee clutch? No, but people like Chuck Wendig are.
Martin would be if it weren't for HBO, though.
Yeah, he probably would.
I mean, if he were just an author, he probably would be.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, now he can attend San Diego and get $500 a person for that. So
now, on the flip side, most of your conventions you go to are like, what, $75, $100 maybe to go to?
You're not really talking about a fan convention either, though. You're talking about more of a B2B convention kind of thing.
Sort of. I mean, what I'm talking about, like, your regular conventions is $100. For Worldcon, it's a little more expensive. But here's the kicker. If they broke even on it, they actually mail you a check back.
Wow.
That happened to me. That came out of the blue. Like 2 years later, they were like, because when you sign up, that not only do you sign up for the convention, you also sign up to vote on the Hugo. And then you also get the privilege of nominating for the next Hugo. So I went, I voted, I came back. They're like, congratulations, we're all wrapped up. We did well. Here's your check, totally reimbursing you for your convention.
Yeah, can you imagine if, you know, 80,000, 100,000 people had the vote for, you know, best comic book or something like that?
WorldCon, even though it is WorldCon and it goes out to other countries every other year and it comes back and it jumps to different places, it only has like 5,000-6,000 people to it. It always wanted to be a small, like you said, a small literary convention where their fans are welcome, but there is a lot of B2B stuff that goes on too. In fact, when I went, it had a weird kind of demographic to it. A lot of the younger people going were all aspiring writers. There were very few actual young fans going. And then there weren't very many middle-aged people there unless they were already there in a professional capacity. So I was kind of odd man out being middle-aged and trying to be an aspiring writer there. And then for the older crowd, there were fans and professionals in kind of equal measure. Because a lot of these people, they get into the authors that were big in the 70s, 80s, and even the 60s. Which, you know, now there's kind of a disconnect between what's going on now for media stuff and what went on back in those days. Which is kind of sad because, you know, I love and power armor anime like the next guy does. But, you know, it would be nice to see that Robert Heinlein got a little more of a props to what he did versus just the movie that was kind of a satire.
Tom and I talk about this all the time. The book is great. The movie is great, but they're just not related by anything other than name.
Exactly.
And it is kind of unfair to Heinlein that when people think, when you shout Starship Troopers in a crowded theater, that's what they think.
I agree. We're getting into the inside baseball of geekdom, aren't we?
We usually do.
But especially with Heinlein. I mean, you know, that goes right back to where we went before. H.P. Lovecraft, who kind of pseudo-created this whole mythos that people have taken and run with. Racist on top of that. He's being enduring, and Heinlein is starting to sort of fade. It's a little frustrating for me in that front. So I'm glad to see that Tolkien's not fading by any means.
Well, again, you get your movies. No one would have read Tolkien in the last 10 years. Except us nerds, if it hadn't have been for, you know, Hollywood.
Can't argue with that. So with WorldCon, you know, it's made it worth going there as a business expense to network. Because there's panels, there's lots of panels about how to start your own stuff. There were lots of panels about how to start up your own ebook stuff. And some of the panels are with agents. And there was not a fan of an agent there at the coffee clutches. It was all aspiring writers trying to go, so what are you interested in, Mr. Agent? As in the back of the mind, you're figuring out how his input is going to, you know, tweak your pitch to him later. At the very least, people need to think about those sort of expenses. You just can't really throw something out there and expect or hope the slush pile is going to be kind to you, because that's not going to happen. There needs to be investments you have to make in addition to your dedication.
That's true even with e-publishing now, because I know a lot of people think like, well, I just write a book and make it a PDF and put it on Amazon and, you know, there's a billion people buying books, so 10,000 will buy mine.
Funny you should start me on e-publishing now, because I have just finished up 7 short stories and I just finished up doing an audiobook. The short stories are already up and out on Amazon. The audiobook, we're almost there, because Amazon is working with Audible to do the same thing with audiobooks that they've done with ebooks. It's different now. When Hugh Howey got big, part of what helped is that he was new to the scene. It was still kind of a virgin sort of scene. There weren't many people spiking, so if you did spike, you could just get some synergy off that. He was lucky because he was on the cutting edge, not saying he didn't deserve what accolades he received. If you think what you said now, that you're just going to be able to throw it out there, you're now going to be lost in the static. You got to have a plan. And then cross your fingers the plan works. My plan, I'll just tell you what it was part of it was a bit of Hugh Howey, and part of it was what I learned at WorldCon. The Hugh Howey part was, you know, he said, I just kept throwing short stories out there, and after I got like 10 or so of them, you know, something started to steamroll, and I listened to my fans, and I started giving them what they wanted, and this is where I am today. So then I decided that if I was going to put out short stories, I was going to put out a whole batch at once to start with. Because then if they did like one, they could go and snag another, and then they'd have something there versus, oh, I've got one short story, and then when I put one out 3 months later, they've already moved on to something else. And if they really liked what I had, they could jump onto the next thing. and I could at least get a fix, two or three stories from me, and then I would stick in the brain a little bit more. And then from the WorldCon spot, when I went to the e-publishing panels, learning how to do convert over to e-books and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of ironic. I'll get to that later. One of the companies, Open Road Media, they kind of like liked the brag that they took trade dress, which is basically when you look at a book and you know all the books are in a series, that's called trade dress. They said they decided instead of doing trade dress for just a particular series of an author, that all of their books with them should have a certain look and a certain style. So even though one book of his might be horror and another book of his might be fantasy, you looked at him and at least you knew everything was from him at just a visual glance. You just had a style you could tell. And that's what I did. In fact, if you look at my stuff, you'll see the one short story I did the cover for before I went to this panel. I went, oh, this is how I need to do it. And you'll see everything else looks completely different, but still has the same kind of vibe to it that you can look at and go, you know what? I think that's a Christopher Robin Negline story.
I would like to just say, because some of the authors on my books have done this, if you ever get picked up, absolutely insist that they keep that, because it drives me nuts having the first 12 books in a series look one way and then a new publisher, well, we're going to dress you this way now.
I'm sure that's mostly related to ego. They don't want their stuff to look like their competitors. And just to let you know what my theory was behind my book covers was I didn't have much cash. I need something straight and simple. So for me, we took stuff that was royalty-free pics or royalty-free images. We wanted to kind of have a clip art vibe to them where they're mostly silhouettes. So that would kind of stand out. And then we would have, you know, just a simple color background. And then my byline is the same font throughout. Now, the actual fonts for the top, or they have a little variety to them, and actually they are also kind of coded by genre. So all my horror short stories will have a certain font for the title, but my science fiction stuff will have a different kind of font for the title. But overall, you still have that kind of clip arty. When I say clip art, don't think of the standard Microsoft clip art. We mean it's just like a silhouetted image of some sort.
It's royalty free. That's evocative. Like, that's what it's called these days. It's not clip art anymore. It's
royalty-free. Oh, okay. Even then, royalty free. There's some stuff that's quote unquote royalty free, but they still find a way to make you pay for it. So you have to find rights free, royalty free stuff, which can be kind of hard. If you have friends, I suggest having them help you. I had a friend help me with the audiobook. I had a wonderful friend help me with with my book covers. And I had another friend who helped supply some of that art. And just a heads up, that's also a big thing that's going on is how much should you use your fans and volunteers, especially when it comes to social media and stuff. Where do you cross that line from, you know, having your fans help you out to like you're getting free labor out of them? There was a Dutch author at that WorldCon who pretty much was pretty proud that he got a whole horror book trailer like for free because all his fans, they were the extras and the other fans did the sound and some other fans did the photo shoot and the whole nine yards. Like literally, his thing was he showed up with like the alcohol and like free copies of his book to say thank you to everybody.
As long as the fans feel it was a positive experience, I'm kind of all for that. That's awesome. As a fan, I would have loved to have been involved in something like that.
Then hey, then you know that's not a line that's crossed. I guess it is. As long as you give the fans an experience that they appreciate and some one-on-one time with you, I think that's a perfectly legit reward.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you know that big triangle, right, where you can get something either free, good.
or quick.
Yeah, well, you're already getting it free. That's been my frustration. I'm always kind of a very go-go-go guy, which kind of conflicts with the entire publishing process. Because nothing in the publishing process is fast. If you're hoping to write something today, and you maybe in 2 years you're going to be able to like live off your fiction writing, either face up that it's going to be literally decades or quit now. One of the two, because it's going to be a long road. Might be rewarding someday, but it's going to be a long road.
That actually touches on some of my favorite advice that I've ever heard for an author, an aspiring author. And I believe it was Stephen King who said it, and it was, quit now. If you can, get out, because this is not
a Yeah, that comes from
hobby.
Stephen King, who did good.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that was his thing. He's like, this is not a hobby. This is not a summer job. This is an all-consuming passion that you have to get out or you will die. If you can leave, leave.
Like to put it in a more soul-crushing context for you, Think of how it was for Stephen King's time versus us now. In Stephen King's time, they stair-stepped your book advances. So you know, if you were a first-timer, you'd make 5,000, and if that sold well, you'd make 10 and 15 and 20. And eventually, you know, after 5 or 6 years, if you were selling good, you would get, you know, double-digit advances. Nowadays, it's almost like either you're a surefire hit and they're going to give you a big fat advance, or they're going to give you just enough advance so they can write you off on their taxes as a loss. But don't get me wrong. That sounds depressing, but that is the reality of traditional publishing. Would I still sign up for a traditional publishing contract if I got it? Yes. I definitely would have an agent with me to make sure I wasn't getting screwed, because publishing is just a slower version of Hollywood. Everybody's out to try to get what they can get away with. And you have to keep that in mind, including you. Whenever you enter contract negotiations, you should have that same attitude, because if you don't, you're going to get steamrolled. The irony that I'm talking about for Worldcon and learning how to convert my Word documents to an EPUB or MOBI or whatever formats they have, or a PDF, was by the time I got to putting my stuff up on the web, you didn't need to do that anymore. If you work with Amazon, Smashwords, or Barnes & Noble's Nook, they literally have it one-stop shopping. You bring in your Word document, you fill out your paperwork. There is paperwork. They need to know where your bank is. They need to know your tax info. And then they just convert it over to their format for you. In fact, Amazon makes it insidiously easy to just have them handle everything for you. So you just want to click on that, yes, I want to be your exclusive partner. No one else can get my stuff, Amazon, but you, because you've made it so easy that I don't have to do anything other than throw up a Word document. I don't even need a book cover, because you have a whole book cover little software package that I can just click on and make my stuff easy for me. You know, the thing is Amazon is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The fear is if we all cave in and go to Amazon directly, then when there's no other competition and Amazon has a monopoly, they can just change up everything. And, you know, what they want is they want content, desperately want content. You know, for them, they see it's a machine they need to keep feeding. In fact, I'm going to go back to Chuck Wendig for a moment. Because his example of that need for content was, and I apologize in advance for anybody who may be offended, because if you haven't read Chuck Wendig's blog yet, here's a sample. He said, I could literally throw up a novel, 100,000 words of the word fart repeated, with a baboon drinking its own piss on the cover, and Amazon would accept it and publish it for me.
Yeah, I don't think they manage content whatsoever. If someone wants to buy it, they'll let them, won't they?
Within 24 hours, somebody else who had read the blog did exactly that. They created a 100,000-word novel with the word fart repeated, and the cover was a baboon tactfully drinking its own piss. And Amazon, the only reason Amazon pulled it down is because it was starting to raise a whole Twitter kind of wave of people realizing that. Eventually they did bring it back, and it is now something you can buy for charity. But that was just to prove that, you know, that they don't really watch the content. And that's part of, you know, what's going on with e-publishing. And I think to some degree it doesn't – that third-party validation you get from traditional publishing is something you just still can't get from e-publishing yet. The idea that someone else has thought this was worth the investment of printing on paper and putting on the shelf. Because remember, if you could take your Word document and not even need anyone else to throw it up on the web and put a cover on it, that means everyone else can too. So that just gives you an idea of how much static is out there that's competing with your particular piece.
I'm a big fan of free ebooks. There's a lot of people that do it just for promotional, you know, read this one and I hope you'll buy the next one or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of mailing lists where, you know, every day this one's free or that one's free. I read a lot on my phone, and usually the books that I actually want to read, I'll go out and buy. Like, it's just a thing. I just like to have those books on my shelves so that it's not suited to ebooks. Of the free ones I do read, there's some real crap out there.
Well, you know, that's one of the things we have to think about is, you know, it's not vetted. If e-publishing wants to kind of pull itself up by its bootstraps and be taken seriously, we're going to have to find a way to get better vetting other than just we've turned the world into our slush pile. I think at one point when it was still kind of new, one of the attitudes writers had was, well, it's e-publishing and it's all brand new, so I'm going to throw something out there and, you know, I'm going to get feedback from my readers. Some of my feedback will improve my storytelling craft. A lot of it will be the typos I find. So, I mean, stuff like that has to go if e-publishing wants to kind of get to the next level. For me, I mean, for the longest time, I've always wanted to write very creative, crazy stuff, and it's made it just, you know, hard for me to find to get pitched and sold. One of the reasons why it motivated me to finally put some stuff out ebook wise, and I'm talking short stories. When I say ebook, just immediately throw in e-short story for now. For an example, I have a Weird West story, actually a Weird West novel I've been trying to sell, and agents come back to me and they tell me horror and Western are the two worst genres to pitch right now. No one's interested. Nobody can do it. And that's very odd because I have on my shelf 2 to 3 different Weird West comic books that are bestsellers right now. Sixth Gun, All-Star Western, stuff like that. My bestseller is just a straight-up zombie novel with a twist at the end. But that twist is a little unique. But nobody thought, you know, part of it would be like people would be like, well, zombies have been done. And they're like, oh, I like that twist, but no, zombies have been done.
Well, zombies have been done lately. Right? Yeah, I mean,
I know. But it's the thing that sells on my ebooks. You explain that to me. The thing that was the real motivator for me to start the whole e-publishing adventure is I got a rejection from a short story. And the rejection was, this read like a really fun Buffy episode, but it's not for us. We're looking for something more literary.
We don't like fun.
Well, as a small digression, is a lot of these short story magazines, they need to look for stuff that they can throw up that either has brand name recognition to it or is a very literary, amazing story. So if you have no name, you better knock them out of the park. Mm. That might be something if you want to keep doing the short story and submit it traditionally. You know, you have to keep that in mind that if you're going to submit to them, you need to have a story that just knocks it out of the park, and it better be picture perfect and no typos. In fact, there's been an explosion lately. We kind of had a cutoff where all the print magazines for science fiction and fantasy were dying, and now they're kind of, you know, 5 or 6 years later, they're now blossoming online. And even then, it still might get rejected. I just had a rejection this week, and the rejection came with feedback, and I was happy. I mean, that's how screwed up writing is, that somebody can say, no, thank you, but let me tell you what you did wrong, and you're happy because it means they actually really liked your story, and 9 times out of 10, they'll finish it with your next story, please submit again, because you've gone to the short list, that somebody's actually seeing your writing, they see the talent, and they're crossing their fingers that someday you'll slide something across their desk that will fit what they want. And then you have to start submitting stuff to them again and again and again until you get lucky with that. So when I read that, and I realized that these short story fiction magazines want more literary stuff because it makes sense for them for that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to put it online. I'm going to do the e-publishing thing. We'll see where it goes. And that's where Small Town Nights is. I call it my redneck monster hunter story, but there's a little bit more to it than that. Because that's how you have to pitch things to people. You can't just say, well, there's this twist and that twist.
It's your elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Redneck monsters.
That's right. Redneck monster hunter. But, I was at a panel at a local convention, and like this girl, she wanted to ask for writing advice, but she had to give us like the entire plot of the story and each individual character and how the characters were related or wanting to get related to each other. You've lost yourself in the weeds, dear, that you don't even know what question to ask. So yeah, keeping things to an elevator pitch helps. But I, you know, I've done zombie, I've done Monster Hunter, did straight up horror. I have a dark fairy tale one. Basically, it's a world where the gourmet dish is the same as casting a spell. You know, that if you eat escargot, you're going to move very slowly. And imagine what those kind of things can trickle out and have happen. And then I have 3 short stories in a series, very crazy post-apocalyptic way in the future. So it's post-apocalyptic for the 3rd civilization after ours. I don't know if Jack Vance rings a bell for you, but kind of the dying Earth sort of scenario where magic and science fiction exist together. And sometimes you can't tell the difference between the two. You know, is he controlling nanobots or is he casting a spell? How do you know the difference at this point? And it's about a thief's adventures in this very crazy world where you don't know where anything is anymore, but it's very fantastical with crazy alien races. They may not be alien. They just may be a different kind of human. So that's sort of the stuff I have up there. The most popular one, like I said, was a zombie story, and the 2nd most popular is the Redneck Monster Hunter. In fact, the zombie one got 5 stars already.
You seem to do a lot of sub-sub genres.
That's why I think I have issues when it comes to traditional publishing, because I get a really crazy, very niche story going on, and I don't think people know what to do with it as far as trying to pitch it to somewhere or trying to put it in their magazine. The story that just got rejected is a lot more straightforward. It is a slightly steampunk fantasy world where it's a little topsy-turvy. The humans are second-class citizens that do all the base labor in farming, while the cities are run by the greenskins, the goblins and the hobgoblins, and the orcs.
Is that a reptilian anecdote?
No. It's just a crazy way for me to have a very, you know, kind of corrupt, crazy sort of society that kind of plays up all the shticks of fantasy and corrupt city guards and politicians and things like that.
It's not really subversive political fiction?
No, not even remotely. It's more, actually, it's funny, my biggest comment was to just keep to the fun action adventure stuff. Now that I've just done something that's a lot more straight on fantasy, I realize that I have a much bigger market to sell it to. So I'm going to take the advice and I'm going to tweak it a little bit and I'm going to submit it to the next magazine and cross my fingers. You know, and then I'm still plugging away on my novels. In addition to the weird Western novel I got going on, right now I'm trying to write something. I don't know if it's young adult or if it's a novel with young adults in it. It's a very fantasy style sort of thing. It's proto steampunk. You know, that's the kind of novel I'm working on right now.
Well, man, I really hope some of those changes work out for you. I think you deserve a wider audience for sure. I know your time for today is just about up, but make sure to let us know when that new stuff of yours is out, and we'll tell everybody about it and post links to where they can get it and do whatever we can to kind of get you out there a little bit more.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me. It was a great time.
Of course. Any parting words?
If you want to be a writer, here's your main advice. Write. Every day. Write. That's it.
Sounds easy.
Oh, yes, it does.
All right, man. Thank you again.
You bet. Bye.
And thank you, loyal listeners, for tuning in once again. Before we sign off for the evening, I'd like to remind you to check us out on iTunes, where you can rate us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed tonight, and make comments about what you liked or didn't like about the show, or the streaming service Stitcher if you prefer that. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, join our Google Circle, and join our Nerdstravaganza HQ Facebook group. Visit our website at www.nerdstravaganza.com. And if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com. And if you don't, I'll see you next week.